This is an oral interview with Mr. Alan Neidel as part of the Polar Oral History Project conducted by the American Polar Society and the Byrd Polar Archival Program of The Ohio State University on a grant provided by the National Science Foundation. The interview was conducted at Mr. Neidel's home in Washington, D.C. by Brian Shoemaker on 19 July 2000. Mr. Neidel, you've had a tremendous career with State Department, but specifically we're interested in the Antarctic Treaty because this is a polar oral history program, and you had a role to play in the Antarctic Treaty negotiations. First, we'd like to know something about your background as to where you were educated, how you got to State Department, and why you were presented with the problem of negotiating the Antarctic Treaty.
Okay, start with college.
Sure.
I went to Yale College between 1946 and 1950. My major was history of art. I rebelled against the sciences, actually. I had thought when I graduated that I was going to be an art dealer. And then the Korean War came along and I decided to enlist and was in the Army for 3 years, during which time I became much more conscious of the serious world issues that faced us, and I wanted to participate in all of those, so I decided to go to law school, where I went from 53 to 56 at the University of Michigan. And in accord with my interest, I took as much international law as I could, almost a major, although you don't have those in law school. And I read and studied about diplomacy. I was very lucky because I had a mentor, a man named Bishop, who was the legal advisor to Acheson, sat with him during the peace treaty negotiations in Europe. So I gained from him what I think was a real life appreciation of how countries and negotiations work in the real world of sports.
Yeah. What year was that you were with, this is Dean Acheson?
No, I wasn't with Dean Acheson.
You
I was
Acheson.
With, yeah.
Yeah.
I was with an international lawyer who was now a professor the University of Michigan, and he worked intimately with Dean Acheson on all the peace treaties after World War II.
I see. But you weren't directly involved
no,
with Dean Acheson?
No. Okay. So when I finished law school, I applied to the State Department, but in those days it was very small, a legal staff, and I had to wait a year, during which time I was with a corporate law firm in Kansas City, Missouri. But I was called within the year to come for my interviews at the State Department and was hired to begin, I think it was around January 57. I was hired, actually interviewed by Herman Flager. I was a fairly young guy at this time. Although I was a veteran and a graduate of law school, I guess I was, was born in 29, so that made me 28. So I was put into a division of the legal staff for Inter-American Affairs and Extradition. And one of the things that I was most interested in as a new employee there was negotiation. I had a talent for this as a boy, and my father, who was a small businessman but a nuclear scientist, saw this and encouraged me. So I had studied a lot of books, a lot of memoirs on how you negotiate, how you successfully negotiate. And in my first year in the legal advisory staff, I did a variety of things, but two that I'm most remembered and most proud of was that I negotiated more or less on my own at the age of 28 or 29, two treaties. One was the U.S.-Brazil Extradition Treaty, which was something of a tour de force since they thought we were racists and had refused and resisted negotiation, and had been unsuccessful negotiations for something like 50 years with several attorneys general.
Which year was this that you did this?
1957, I think. Could have been beginning of 58. 57 or beginning of 58.
Sure.
And I did the same with Sweden, which had similar obstacles. And both were successful, which surprised a lot of people. They thought they were hopeless tasks, which was why they let me fuss with it. Towards the end of the first year or at the beginning of the second year, my boss, who was Marjorie Whiteman, came to me and said that they needed a full-time legal advisor for a new negotiation or possible negotiation. During that first, are we recording?
Yes, say I'm going to add.
I'm going to add one thing about my first year experience. I also did a few highly political legal things for Herman Flager. One, for example, was to write a statement for Foster Dulles on our policy on non-recognition of China, which actually he delivered verbatim at a press conference. Mm-hmm. But I kept in touch with Flager in this kind of assignment, and so was known to him and known to be, you know, a pretty good subordinate, I guess. So let's get on with the Antarctic Treaty. The Antarctic assignment was handled in the State Department up to this time in the Latin American Bureau. This was because of the Argentine and Chilean claims. And now, obviously, there were a lot of other interests, like British and Belgian and so forth. But it was in the Latin American Bureau. Now, click please. Okay, why was I approached? Well, because I was connected with the Inter-American Bureau, but also, I guess, because I'd done very well at negotiating assignments. Now, this was a pretty attractive assignment, sort of glamorous in a way, and my boss, who was an elderly woman, a very distinguished international lawyer, was also absorbed on another big project, the Journal of International Law, and not the journal, great treatise on international law. And she couldn't spend, you know, full time or give it the time, so I was chosen, and I was a very junior person at this
now,
time.
Now, this is Mrs. Whiteman?
Yeah. But I was a very junior person. I was probably a GS, still 7 or maybe even a 9. Now, why was Daniels chosen? Well, we got to back up a little. These are things maybe I learned a little later, but this is what I believe, what I was informed happened. There had recently been a meeting of either CETO or ANZUS, a security meeting in which Dulles participated and the Australians. And Australian Foreign Minister Casey approached Secretary Dulles and said, this is what I was told, I wasn't present, and said, look, we are in the area of the Antarctic. We're neighbors of the Antarctic. And the Russians are coming in, and we should try to do something to see to it that they don't make trouble, that they don't do something militarily disadvantageous to us. we want to work with you. We hope to get you interested to take some steps about this. So I understand that it was a rather vague approach. They didn't have a specific proposal. They were just laying a problem before us.
Yes, do you needed rules to operate, or?
Well, I don't even know that they said rules. I don't know more than what I've told you. And Dulles came back, and he wanted to appoint a kind of special person to take this on full time, not just sort of turn it over to the Inter-American Bureau. The door, please. The door, please.
Yeah.
Cerrada la puerta.
But he did go to the Inter-American Bureau because that's where the assignment was lodged. And somebody, I don't know who exactly, came up with the name of Ambassador Paul Daniels, who I think may have just retired, and was called back. And he had been ambassador to a number of important Latin American countries. I think Peru was one. Can you click, please? Anyway, he was appointed, and one of the first things he did was to assemble a team. So he's the one, I believe, who came to my boss and asked to have a lawyer assigned to be the legal advisor. So let me stop for a moment. So he assembled this team, which I think consisted roughly of a couple of diplomats beside himself, fellows from the Foreign Service, fellow from the historian's office, myself, and I don't remember the others. I think about six or seven of us. And we met with him, and I soon learned that this was really a wonderful assignment from my standpoint. Not only was it a very significant issue, but Daniels conducted this in what I considered a very old-fashioned but very sound and excellent diplomatic manner. We analyzed the problem, the possible approaches, the ways to go about it, when to go to other countries, whether to start with principals. What I think we came up with, as I remember, is that we would work for a policy statement by, I think it was Eisenhower even. Click. So this was an initiative. The format, the procedure, the steps were worked out by this little group, with Daniels playing a very, very active leading role. And all went smoothly. We issued this, we formulated, developed this statement, which was issued by the president. And then countries responded, and all of the countries, the approach was to include all of the countries that had been active in Antarctica. So they were invited, and including the Russians, and they came, and there was established a working group, which I think held over the course of the next 6-9 months or so, 60 meetings. And everybody was...
How many meetings?
I think 60 meetings of the preparatory. 60.
6-0, okay.
I think so, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
One of the things that interested me as a kind of student of negotiation and someone who saw themselves, accurately as it turned out, as headed for a career in negotiation, was Daniel's way of drawing everybody in, getting all the views, consulting everybody, having everybody kind of be part of the process. And this was really, very good thing. So now we come to the meetings of the Preparatory Commission, if that's what it was called, which took place at the Science Foundation across the street from the State Department. And he picked everything with very considered calculation that this was a good kind of non-political venue, you know, Science Foundation.
I need to talk about that. You're talking about the National Academy of Sciences.
Right across the street.
Yes, okay.
And
the National Science Foundation is...
That's right, the Academy of Sciences. And we met in a room there, and everybody came. My guess is that it was about once a week, but you'll know exactly. Now something you'll be interested in was the role of the Russians. Well, first of all, everybody else had ideas and things to contribute on these principles. I don't remember exactly how many principles there were or just what they were, but they probably included much that was in the treaty. The Russians took a very stiff and uncooperative view at the outset, as you probably know. And their main line was that these you're asking me questions, or I should continue?
No, continue.
The Russian line was that these talks were invalid because the People's Republic of Germany, you know, East Germany, was not present. And immediately there was a question how to respond to this. And Daniels had what I thought was, you know, the perfect diplomatic line, which was just to let them have their say and then to go on. And he calculated, I think, quite correctly, well, it was correct in the event, that they wouldn't walk out because they'd want to hear what everybody else was saying. They wouldn't want to miss the opportunity to collect all that information and intelligence. So they sat through the meetings, you know, glum-faced, silent, having made their ritualistic statement that these meetings were invalid. And in the meantime, the rest of us, with everybody's pretty full, serious cooperation, developed a whole catalog of ideas and refinements and some new suggestions and all the rest about the principles. And halfway through this exercise, roughly halfway through, we came to a meeting and the Russians said at the beginning, we have a statement to make. We didn't know what to think of it, whether it was just the same old thing or something new. And they came forth with a whole catalog of comments on the points that had been discussed by others. And that was the breakthrough. We knew something had happened. And
what happened?
Well, what we later were led to believe, I think we learned this not immediately, because the Russians weren't too free with information in these days, you know, even in Corridor talks. But I think what we learned when the very senior Russian negotiator came to the conference later,
Who was that?
He was the legal advisor of the Russian Foreign Ministry, which kind of paralleled our appointment of our legal advisor to the State Department, Herman Flager.
I see.
But he told us that Khrushchev had formally made the decision to participate seriously in this. And this was specifically part of the response to the challenge which we were always giving to the Russians and the Soviets, and which we had given them, at, you know, in this early time, was still in the late 50s, to show us that they could behave, you know, seriously like, you know, any other nation. And this was part of their program to do that. So anyway, the work of this preparatory commission proceeded fairly quickly after this. And now I have to inject about the drafting of the treaty, the first treaty text. I think this happened before the formal treaty conference, but I'm not positive. What I remember, if I had to guess, I'd be fairly certain of it. But anyway, what happened was that one day Ambassador Daniels said to me, "Alan, I think it's time we had a treaty text." And we had gone through many months, you know, talking principles, circulating statements and so forth. But he said to me, "I think we need a, you know, full treaty text in treaty language, draft one." So I went back to my office, you know, pretty excited. This was, you know, quite an assignment. And I sat at my typewriter, stared at the damn thing, and I said, "How do you start the most important treaty, multilateral, with the Russians since the World War II? Because this would be the first treaty limiting the military activities of the Soviet Union in any significant way." So I sat and scratched my head, and finally I came up with a sentence: "Antarctica shall be used for peaceful purposes only, period." And it occurred to me,
the heart and soul of the treaty.
Yes, it occurred to me that this should be simple. It should be as simple and straightforward as you can make it. This isn't the place to sound like a bond document or a property clause in a deed of trust. So that's what I came up with. And the amazing thing, you know, I didn't know it at the time, but I've reflected on it a lot since, is that in all the remainder of the preparatory meetings and in all the negotiations, nobody had a suggestion to improve that sentence. It remained untouched from that point to signature of the treaty. So that is a pretty remarkable thing. I think that happens very, very rarely, and it may even be unique.
It probably is very unique.
Probably unique.
Because they wordsmith, don't they?
That's right, yes. And then something I know you're interested in is what impact this all had on other negotiations. Well,
you mean at the time?
Yeah, a little afterwards. And it wasn't too long after that that there was a multilateral negotiation about outer space. And they just took the sentence from this treaty and said, "Outer space shall be used for peaceful purposes only," in the first article of the treaty. And that was never challenged. So I feel as though I wrote something, you know, in stone, which I still tell people about occasionally when it's relevant.
About the Moon Treaty. The Moon Treaty, same?
Yeah, that's the Outer Space Treaty, okay, yeah. So maybe we should stop here for a moment.
Okay, you want to inject something about an incident?
Right. Before the Russians came around, it had been quite a time that we'd listened to their, you know, quite uncooperative statements. And this produced some reaction within the U.S. government. What were we doing, wasting a lot of time trying to get a treaty with people who really didn't see things our way in the world? And I don't know the names of the people, or I can't remember, or I'm not sure, but there were people, cold warriors, as it were, experienced, respectable, respected, serious people who said this is never going to work. The Russians are not interested in bringing peace to and cooperation with us anywhere. They operate on a zero gain basis. In which any gain for us is a loss for them and vice versa. And if they ever were to decide to cooperate, it would be because they thought they would be doing us in some way or gaining an advantage. And they're not now cooperating because they think that if the treaty were to go forward cooperatively, it would be to their disadvantage. So this thing is never going to work, and we ought to get out while we have a good excuse and can blame them for foot dragging and inserting the East Germans, who have, you know, no business being discussed at all. And Daniels worked very hard above my level to say this was nonsense. You just pursue your interest as you calculate it. You do it patiently. You don't let the other side determine what's in our interest. You know, we decide that, and this treaty, if we got it the way we want, and if they signed and others signed and we had the inspection, would be in our interest. And I think the issue went fairly high, maybe even to the president, although I'm not sure. But it was decided to continue the course of seriously, quietly, without polemics, without publicity, seeking the treaty. And it was a little while after that that the Russians came around. So now let's get to the treaty articles.
A question to ask there in relation to this. Sometime before we began negotiations, Khrushchev in a speech said we're able to fire missiles from not only from the north, but now from the south. And the intimate, hey, what was implied about that by the Australians and New Zealanders, that they possibly meant that they could fire them from their bases in Antarctica. Did that come up?
Yes, that was very much on people's minds.
The Cold Warrior's minds.
Well, everybody's mind.
Yes.
I mean, he must have had a reason for saying that. Now, I think that was one interpretation, fire from bases. Another one was submarines, that the Russians might have ports there or stopovers. And another one was they might have guidance facilities. And I think Khrushchev also said, if I'm not mistaken, something like, you expect something from one direction, and but it comes from the basement or from the cellar or from the opposite direction. And that was taken to mean, you know, a missile attack which had some Antarctic support element. So that's all I know about that. Should we get on to the articles?
Certainly. We talked about Article 1. You want to add anything about that?
No, I don't think so.
How about the continuation of science and research? The words in the treaty says that the research shall continue as before. Tacitly, that means before during the IGY.
Yes.
Because there was peaceful cooperation during IGY.
Yes.
Did you ever discuss the exchange of scientists that occurred during IGY before the treaty was even...
I just really can't recall. I mean, what I think is...
It was very successful.
Yes. What I think at this distant viewpoint is that most of the material in the Treaty on Scientific Cooperation was quite non-controversial.
Non-controversial.
I think so, but there may have been some particular points, I just wouldn't recall.
Well, the scientists from that era, even today, say, well, we'd worked the bugs out in the field before the treaty negotiations began.
I think nobody was anxious to stir that pot.
Okay, so they were non-controversial.
I think so.
Okay. How about the claims issue?
And that was what? Very controversial.
Okay, let's... I'll just turn you loose. I'll ask questions as I see fit.
Well, I don't have a memory of the particular issues, but I know we had to work very hard and very carefully to get particularly the Latins on board. And that's about all I can say about that.
There were some considerations when I was in England about statements that the Latins had made when I wrote on the treaty. Oscar de la Cunha, was he at the meetings?
I don't remember. I don't think so.
But he was involved with it, apparently. But anyway... several negotiators made comments, said, well, I may feel this way, but my country's position is. Did any of that come up?
It could have, but it's just so distant. And mm-hmm.
Recollection. Another issue was that the British, the New Zealanders, Australians, and the French had prior negotiations. And they discussed their claims, and prior to, I guess it was, who was the New Zealander that spoke to Dulles? Casey?
Yes.
Yes.
No, no, Australian.
Australian, foreign minister of Australia. They'd been meeting before this and said that they felt it should be internationalized, which implied that they would be willing to give up their claims for internationalization. They weren't, did they take as tough a position on claims as, say, the South Americans?
I don't have a direct memory, but my assumption would be that they didn't. I mean, I think that for the, this is just a surmise at this point, but I think for the British, once they were supporting the project, they would have understood that it involved doing what we did. But that's a surmise, it's not a direct memory.
Okay. But we have language in there that states that no new claims shall be asserted under the term, the time of the treaty. I think that's quite understandable. No one's supposed to take advantage of their position down there. Did the United States have reservations about that? Let me rephrase my question. We had more of an investment in time and people in Antarctica than anyone who asserted a claim. Did we ever advance this position ourselves?
I don't think so. I don't even remember that it came up.
We were committed
to having access to the whole thing. We would have seen, I feel pretty confident about this, that we would have seen a claim by the U.S. as limiting.
Yes. Claim by the U.S. as limiting. I see. Were we ever taking the position that outright internationalization of the Antarctic was a national policy? Did we state it in those terms, internationalization? Or did we expect that we had...
I don't think so. I don't think we spoke about kind of UN-ish concepts or world order concepts or world structure concepts. I mean, I think we spoke about very practical things.
So we felt we wanted access to the Antarcon.
Yeah, we wanted to be free to claim that we could go anywhere we wanted.
And we recognized no other nation's claim.
That's right.
Okay, that's interesting. Okay, that's very good.
Are we off?
No, we're on. You want to turn it off? No, you have got something that you want to ask. I'll leave it on. We can always edit all that stuff out. I assume that the treaty uncovering the land and the ice shelves is non-controversial.
I would think so also, but I don't have a direct memory of that.
Yeah, well, you might suggest that the ice shelves are open ocean, but in reality you can walk on it, land planes on it, and build bases on it. So it never came up.
I wouldn't say that it didn't. I just don't have a recollection.
Well, what's interesting is that it begins on the edge of the ice shelf.
Yes.
Okay. We just had a 187 by 23 mile iceberg break off, so the ice shelf has moved south. The treaty, it's a fluid thing, but I don't think it's a serious.
Now, I think you can say, though, in a general way, that in these preparatory meetings, virtually every sentence of this was gone over very carefully.
At the preparatory meetings. Yeah, that's a good point. Nuclear testing and nuclear storage of radioactive waste are prohibited by the treaty. What were the discussions behind that?
This was introduced, I think, fairly late, and my vague recollection is by New Zealand in particular, maybe with Australia. And I think it was a tough one for us to swallow because there were other plans and possibilities about handling nuclear testing, which maybe if I can digress to something I think you'll be interested in, the inspection article. The inspection article has no quota of tests, of inspections that are permitted. It has no veto of inspections by the host country. This was a very radical article. In the other disarmament talks, which had taken place under UN aegis, and I don't remember exactly what status they were at the time, but nothing this sweeping that you could, that an inspecting country could go anywhere it wanted at any time was even considered feasible. Now, a lot of people have said that this was because the Russians didn't have national territory there. But my view is that it was still very radical and very important because while for the Russians it would have been extremely difficult to permit this kind of inspection in their territory, it should have also been very difficult for them to permit it in the territory of their encampment, I mean, where the Russian commander is chief. And, you know, God knows, you know, from their standpoint of suspicion and hostility, God knows what suspicions they have of our purposes, whether we're harassing them, whether we're setting them up. So, as I remember, or I think I remember, the Russians never protested that you needed to limit this right of inspection, like by a quota of 2 a year or 1 a year or whatever, or that you have to give a certain amount of notice, or there are many ways to limit inspection. But I don't think they ever demanded this. And it took some time for the rest of the government to realize, the rest of the government, which had been frustrated, you know, month after month, year after year, dealing with the Russians on inspection. Which
on
was
any inspection.
On any inspection. It was a very, very tough nut. That here in this Antarctic treaty negotiation, the all the right principles, you know, in extremely correct form, had fallen right into place. I mean, an inspection wherever you wanted it, you know, wherever you wanted it. It didn't all either say whether, you know, how many inspectors you could have and all the rest, or what kind of inspectors.
Initially, they didn't argue about
I don't think so.
No, they just, it just went by, and everybody was kind of ducking and being quiet. Hoping,
no, I think
were you afraid to raise the issue and say, have you got any comments?
No, I think that if they had raised it as a serious issue, it wouldn't be there.
I understand, but we didn't make a big deal of it, I assume, because we didn't want to really
We wouldn't have said to them, now this is a in advance over the normal approach to inspection.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't have said that.
Yeah.
But we would have been upfront about what the language provided and what rights and duties it required. Sure, well, we wouldn't have hidden anything.
It's got an aerial inspection subclause. Was that Eisenhower part of his open skies?
I doubt it, but I, you know, whether there was some relation, it could have conceivably been, but
which
I think
that?
it was just a good thing to recognize aerial inspection.
His aerial inspection, when did he propose that? Open skies, I mean, 55, 56?
For the in connection with the IAEA, or was it, no, it was a different thing.
Yeah, well,
I don't remember.
Ike wanted open skies.
Everybody wanted them. I mean,
yeah. So, and of course, that got shot down with Kerry Powers.
Yeah.
So it went through quite smoothly then.
I think so. I mean, yeah. I could be wrong. You know, we're talking about 40 some years.
Yes.
But
Well, these are the key articles, these seven. There's another one. The other seven were mostly administrative, like it'll be written in Russian, Spanish, French,
sure,
and English. And it'll be deposited in Washington and that type of thing. But Article 12 said after the period of 30 years since after ratification, that the treaty could be reviewed.
Yes.
What kind of discussions went on behind that?
I can't remember specifically, but I can remember that this was another path-breaking part of the treaty work, the negotiation, because what we found was that with a review, which allowed people to, you know, introduce new proposals, and is this connected to withdrawal? I think it is, isn't it? You know, what is the withdrawal article?
No, that's Article 11.
Yeah, but can you read to me what it summarizes?
I have to do it off the top of my head, but it. Notice of withdrawal has to be given a year in advance. It's possible to withdraw by any nation, but notice of withdrawal has to be given a year in advance if any nation is dissatisfied with the terms of the treaty.
Is there, and do you remember what the clause says about what happens if whether the review conference can end the treaty?
Yes, the review conference says after the expiration of 30 years, a conference should be held to review the treaty. It implies amendment and a decision be made whether the treaty will continue in force into the future.
Right. Well, that's what I was generally remembering, which having that as a kind of a safety valve, I think was helpful in, I'm almost certain, in solving, in assuaging all the sensitivities, that you weren't giving up your the right of recognition of your claim forever. Now, you know that these people are realists. They knew that our position wouldn't change, but still it kind of helped to say that, well, we're going to see how this works, whether we've been prejudiced, whether... you know, whether the whole thing is worth keeping in force. And this was, so I think this was a factor in making the project a success. And as I was saying, this is another one of the precedent-setting aspects of this negotiation, because most of the great treaties after that, a few of which I worked on, like the Non-Proliferation Treaty, had a very similar kind of provision.
In other words, a provision where you can look at it again?
Yes, where you're required to.
And right.
You're required to, and that means that the people who have their reservations, political and domestic and all sorts, can tell their people, well, we aren't in this for perpetuity. We can see what's evolved. It may even look better then, or it may look worse, and we can take action.
And then we can look at it, in this case, 30 years. If it's working, we can continue it. If it isn't working, we can withdraw.
Or we can propose amendments and see whether they're accepted.
Understood. So that was a very serious negotiation that took place over that issue.
Oh, yes. That was an important factor.
Yes. I didn't realize that. But the concerns were mostly by the South American nations. Is that correct?
Well, I can't remember specifically, but... people had a variety of concerns, and I think it was welcomed pretty nearly by everybody.
Okay, welcomed by everyone, huh?
I think so. I mean, I don't think anybody took a very purist line and said this treaty must be, of infinite duration.
Okay. Have you followed the treaty after that?
I did for a few years, and then I turned to other things, and I kind of lost track, and it became a kind of a logistic and a support operation with policy elements, but I kind of didn't have the time to, you know, keep abreast of all the events that were going on with the countries and the inspections. Ready.
Okay, I want to back up a little to the inspection clause. We wound up with a unilateral inspection clause, but there were other nations who were who favored multilateral inspections. What were the discussions in that respect?
Well, once again, with the passage of time, I don't have a specific memory of the discussions, but I think I can remember what our atmosphere was, what our philosophy was. And our philosophy was that this was, you know, a real treaty that was maybe going to come into force. It wasn't just a propaganda debate like some disarmament discussions, unfortunately, came to be. And therefore, you know, we wanted to have our own control. And I think, you know, from this time roughly on, I worked on arms control through most of my career. And I think for us, the idea of having some committee or officials of the UN, you know, be involved, having to vote on an inspection or whatever, would have been anathema. Now, as I say, this is not a specific recollection of actual discussions, but this is a definite recollection of our philosophy.
Did you run these issues by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee before you began negotiations with others over them as to what their position would be?
I do not remember, but I have a general recollection that I had the impression at the time that everything was being done in a very thorough and systematic manner, so I think there must have been adequate consultation, because I don't remember any problem with that. I mean, I don't remember any senators or the Congress being upset with the fact that we were giving anything away or trusting the Russians too much or whatever.
Did you follow the ratification process when it went through, when it came back?
I'm sure I did, but this is another area that I'm sort of a blank on.
Yeah. Did you tell me about Paul Daniels engineered the field work in putting this together. Herman Flegger signed it for the United States. Why?
Well, first of all, he didn't just sign it. He became the chief negotiator at the formal
meetings.
The formal treaty conference, you know, after all the preparatory work. And this was considered a step to enhance the importance and of the negotiation and the power of the delegation. Herman Flegger, besides being a man I think of great brilliance and skill, was a very close personal friend and associate of Secretary Dulles. And therefore, he had not only an assistant secretary level position in the State Department, but he had, you know, an ear to the boss, as which is always enhances your prestige and power. And as a matter of fact, I was very familiar with that situation, because when Dulles asked Flegger to do this, Flegger wanted an assistant, a special assistant. So I became not only the legal advisor to the delegation in the big formal conference, but also the special assistant to Flegger. So I attended with him, you know, all his meetings. And I think I can say, with no disrespect to Daniels, whom I greatly admire, and who, without whom this would not have been possible, because of his very skillful and almost old-fashioned, quiet and calculating pursuit of diplomacy, this would not have happened. But I think that it was the right thing to put Flager in top charge at the, because I, my impression was that he was able to do more.
I mean, he had icing to the cake.
Well, more than icing.
More than
I mean, he had more stature with other parts of the government.
Mm, I see.
Whether with the military, with the Congress. I mean, he was known, not only did he have, I guess, a slightly senior rank to Daniels, who was a retired ambassador, but he had the personal stature of being one of the most influential persons under Dulles.
So he came from San Francisco?
Yes.
Yes.
He was a very successful corporate lawyer.
Went back to being a corporate lawyer after all this.
That's right.
Yes. Well, I appreciate that. It added.
Now, why they didn't have two people signing the treaty, I don't know. In some cases, you do have this.
Yes. Who got the pen?
I have no recollection. But for some reason, the top guy signed, and that was it.
Mm-hmm. Then, and how about the Russians? Who did they upgrade when Flager?
Yes.
Who was their chief negotiator?
I don't remember his name, but he was the legal advisor, and he had an audience, and he may have been an acquaintance, I don't know, with Khrushchev. He got his instructions personally
from Khrushchev
before he came over. And he told us when he came over that Khrushchev has told me to make this a success.
Khrushchev told him that?
Yes.
Khrushchev made a visit to the United States, the San Francisco United Nations, during this period of time of negotiations.
I think it was a little later, wasn't it?
It was when we were worrying about ratification.
Oh, right.
He spoke with Eisenhower. Was Eisenhower, did he raise the issue of this treaty?
I have no knowledge.
You know. Did Dulles ever get personally involved with, who was Dobrynin still then?
Dulles was very involved in the formulation and the approval of our policy as developed by, mainly by Daniels. Whether he took issues up with the Soviet ambassador, I do not know. I tend to think that if he did, it was very rarely. And it may have been virtually never, other than an occasional general way. Because we worked things out at our level, and we're able to.
I'm trying to think of questions that, you know, that all of a sudden the Russians change. They got orders from somebody. They didn't make that decision.
Well, from Khrushchev, probably.
So, well, that's what I'm getting at. It sounds like it came from Khrushchev personally.
Oh, yeah, it would have had to.
Because of their system.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So Khrushchev played a major role in getting this thing going.
Absolutely. Well, in lifting the roadblock.
In lifting the roadblock. But it was Peter the Great wouldn't have allowed unilateral inspections within the Soviet Union, or Russia, excuse me. It's a Russian mentality more than it is a communist mentality, or as much. It was a major step for them, is what I'm asking.
They never tried it, to my recollection, they never tried to trade on that. I mean, mm-hmm. saying, look what we're doing for you in the inspection, you need to do a lot of things for us. My best, very, very vague, dim recollection is that it just went through.
Mm-hmm.
And if there were corrections, they were very minor. And I think the key
Once they
here,
made their mind up to stop stonewalling.
Yeah. And I think, no, they had detailed suggestions, you know, throughout the treaty, like everybody did, once they began to participate. But I think the key was that it was not in normal Russian sovereign territory. And therefore, they didn't consider, and this was a very fortunate thing for us, but they didn't consider that it was a bad precedent, say, to have unlimited inspections on nuclear testing, within the Soviet Union's weapons sites in their territory.
Yes. I asked a question and then had to inject this discussion on ratification.
about following the treaty later. We never made an inspection until 1964. Was there a reason for this?
Now, my recollection is a little different. I mean, it's not specific, but I seem to recall hearing about a Jack Ruina inspection. Do you know who he is?
I don't recall the name.
He was a scientist who was a consultant of the Pentagon, very brilliant man, I think from MIT or Harvard.
Jack Ruina?
Yeah, R-U-I-N-A. And I was told about an inspection, which I would have thought was within a few years. And this was an inspection in which they got to a very far southern Soviet site, and the Soviet commander didn't want to let them in. And they had to do some on-the-spot diplomacy. And finally it dawned on people that the reason for this reluctance was that there was snow mounted up, almost burying some of the buildings or against the walls, and that wasn't supposed to be. And the Soviet commander was afraid there'd be pictures and he would be reprimanded for not keeping his site in perfect order. But I thought all of that happened within, if not the first year, maybe the second or third.
But it wasn't an official inspection. It wasn't a State Department-sponsored inspection.
I would have thought
That's
it was.
A question.
I mean, but I, you know, I can't say for sure. You may be right. I mean, I could have heard about this in 65 or 66, but I doubt it.
Yeah. The story I have on the first inspections, the French and the British said, hey, we've had a breakthrough here. We don't want to really make the inspections. We want the Russians to think about what the significance is. If we start making inspections too early, they might back out. Any of that came up afterwards that you know?
Well, I shifted my work, you know, shortly after this treaty came into mm-hmm. force. So I wouldn't have been privy to that.
Okay. The Cuban Missile Crisis came.
Yes.
And the issue of inspections came up, and the exercise of inspection rights came up. And President Kennedy got involved and ordered the first official inspections, according to my research.
But then it didn't take place for a year after he ordered. He was assassinated in 63.
That's what I said, 64. It was 63, excuse me. I did say 64. I correct myself. There was a great charade of inspections prior to inspecting Russian bases. Say, New Zealanders, who were 2 miles from us, inspected us. We inspected France, Argentina, Great Britain, Chile. The first inspections involved a listening site over at the gun factory here. Paul Daniels was there when the planes were flying to Vostok to make the first inspection. Were you involved in
No.
any of that? Okay. The French and British opposed the inspections because they thought the treaty would fall apart, according to my notes, and Brian Roberts' notes. But you were
No.
not involved in that. I guess at this point, in retrospect, what would you have done differently?
In trying to do the treaty?
From the very beginning, yes. How would you?
I wouldn't have done anything differently. I felt that it was a tremendous opportunity, not only to contribute to something very important in an area that I found fascinating in Antarctica, but also in my main ambition to grow as a negotiator. And I was mainly a learner and a helper. I mean, I'm sure I contributed some ideas, but and comments, because we were all part of a very close team. But I felt that it was an extremely lucky assignment for me, particularly to see a lot of the best principles of diplomacy at work. And that was not such a common thing in those days, because those were high Cold War days. And diplomacy, you know, was corrupted, or I won't say corrupted, but had to take on the added burdens of being, you know, a propaganda exercise as well, and putting the blame on others, and so forth. So I got this chance to really see the best of classical diplomacy, and it kind of all worked out.
I've thought of a retrospect question. Eisenhower, how often was he briefed during this?
I think relatively often. I mean, the system there for with national security advisors is geared to do that. I mean, I couldn't say how often we were, I mean, at this juncture, at this distance, how often we prepared an evening note or a status report for the secretary's office to forward to the White House, which would then go to the national security advisor, and he would determine, you know, what to tell Eisenhower. Unless Dulles sent Eisenhower his own notes. But I think Eisenhower was kept informed, as, you know, as much as he needed to be. And, you know, he was a positive supporter of the whole thing.
Of disarmament in general?
I think he was if I remember correctly, he was a positive supporter, unlike some others in the government, of agreements with the Russians that were hard-headed, you know, had inspection, and were based on our interest. And there's even one anecdote, which I don't remember where I got it from, whether I got it from a book or a diplomat or a reporter, that when Khrushchev came in, or shortly thereafter, we issued a challenge. If you're serious about wanting to bring peace to the world, change your positions, negotiating seriously on a number of things. And one of them was an Austrian peace treaty. And the anecdote is that when the Russians reversed on that one and were finally willing to bring that lengthy, disputed issue to a conclusion, the anecdote is that Dulles went into Eisenhower and said, "My God, what are we going to do? The Russians are say they're ready to negotiate on Austria. How do we pull this back?" And Eisenhower is reported in this anecdote to have said, "What are you talking about? When they do what we ask them to do, we do it."
Yeah. Dulles thought we might have agreed.
But I don't know, this may be apocryphal. I mean, this is not, this was out of my realm. But,
okay. Well, that's great. Well, that's pretty much it. It's very enlightening.
Well, I may have given more opinions than I have a basis for, but I've tried to be careful when they're just sort of impressions, as opposed to recollections that have hardened.
I probably should ask if you know of others who are involved in the working committee meetings. Are they still around?
You ought to be able to get a delegation list. I have no idea.
I have the delegation list. I just wondered if there was anybody.
There's a man who was young, about my age, maybe a little older, who might still be around, Miller. think his Miller was from the historian's office.
From the State Department historian's office?
Yes. Or maybe it was the intelligence office, but his function there was to kind of specifically to keep a record. It may have been Warren Miller, but I'm just not sure. He was not a Foreign Service officer.
Mm-hmm.
I can... the other one I remember is a man named Owen, or Owens, who was older, who I think was probably in his 50s, and was not in particularly good health. And I would doubt whether he would be alive. He might be in his 90s now. But more likely, you have to be in his 90s, probably. Yeah. There's another man whose face I can picture, who had a kind of Polish name. You'll see it on the delegation, who was a young Foreign Service officer.
In retrospect, a further retrospect, are you aware of, certainly this was a breakthrough with the Russians cooperating, that's probably history making, it affected other
things. Yes.
But the treaty itself, how did the operation of the treaty affect negotiations in follow-on treaties, START, SALT? I know.
We're on tape.
We're on tape.
Never directly. The issues were, usually so different. And the issues kind of sorted themselves out. And you couldn't kind of, the Antarctic Treaty had special issues. It was, limited multilateral. Unlike the non-proliferation, which was general multilateral. There were, special circumstances that had led to it. So you couldn't draw on it. And now this is interesting because I was involved in the succeeding years in 4 or 5 major negotiations, maybe 6, I don't know. But we drew on things as positive kind of momentum building experiences whenever we could, and so did the Russians. So that, like for a review conference or for a withdrawal or for, somebody would say, well, now here's what we did in this one. Is there any reason we can't do it now? It'll be easy to clear. We don't have to argue all the merits. And you'd look for help with anything you could find there, but there wasn't much in the Antarctic Treaty. The review conference concept was a carryover. And then I say this is the way it kind of specifically worked. In a general way, the successes tended to strengthen the hand of those who thought you could conduct a productive diplomacy with the Russians, with patience, but hard-headed, assessment of the situation. Because, as I mentioned, up to the time of the Antarctic Treaty, and even following it, there was, a strong school of thought, zero-sum game was what I was getting at before, that we were basically in a zero-sum game with the Soviet Union. And some aspects of this philosophy with a very moralistic tone came back with a vengeance when Reagan and his people took office. That arms control treaties were a trap or a delusion. And they didn't just say philosophically, because if the Russians saw something in it, it meant that they were working to disadvantage us. It wasn't as simple as that for the Reaganauts. They they felt that there was something immoral about making a compromise with the Russians, or some of them did.
With the evil empire.
Yeah.
But Reagan signed the INF Treaty.
That came late, didn't it? That was...
86.
Was Gorbachev in power then?
Yes.
I think Gorbachev was, you know, the new friend of Reagan's.
Yes, buddy.
And Reagan changed his view. And some of what I was describing wasn't as spelled out, as intellectualized by Reagan, but it was by his people. But anyway, that's not our subject. And all I'm saying is that when you had something that was clearly a success, it strengthened the hand of those people who wanted to look for other ways to make diplomatic progress, as opposed to military standoff only.
Mm-hmm. Today, we have unilateral inspections in the Soviet Union. They're Russia now, and they here.
Which are you referring to?
I'm talking about the missile inspections that we have the ACTA set up, Arms Control Disarmament Agency out of Dulles, to accommodate the Russians when they want to make inspections, and they have a similar system set up at St. Petersburg for us to fly in and make inspections within so many hours of their missile sites. And we have permanent inspectors, two in Russia and two in the United States. Do you think the functioning inspections that we made in Antarctica contributed to this?
I have no way of knowing.
Ed Rowney felt it did, but he said felt.
Well, I think I could go along with that. I mean, you make a crack in the problem, and it's there. But I just have no knowledge of Soviet discussions on this.
It's interesting. Nice speculation to say. Did you know that we always made a statement after our unilateral inspections that thank you very much. We'd like to continue these inspections in a broader sense. With inspections in the Soviet Union and the United States.
No, I didn't know.
Yeah, they made a statement like that every time. I was on two inspections. I did it both. Mm-hmm. I understand they did it since the very first. I have nothing else that I can scratch my head to think. I'm scratching around. I think this was really a good interview. It was succinct. And it's extremely informative because these things haven't been done. I think we've lost sight of them. Certainly, the Antarctic Treaty has grown into what they call an Antarctic Treaty system. There's a meeting every year.
Right. There is something I could comment on that might be of interest. I think that this negotiation, this whole policy effort, which started, you know, not with a treaty negotiation, but with a planning effort, first, as I mentioned, in the Daniels group, and then with other countries, bringing them into it, and then proceeding to a treaty text and a review of it. The American side, the American team, was, I think, enormously helped by the fact that this was, in essence, the first time. And much later, in ways that I would experience, you know, firsthand, the bureaucratic tangle in Washington, the bureaucratic obstacles, the bureaucratic system, was enormously more difficult. And the reason for the difference was because, one, people didn't have experience. They didn't really expect success, a lot of people. This was just something the State Department was doing. Now, the thing was not control of our key weapons, like missiles or our TESS, so it didn't kind of cut through to the nerve. But I'm sure that if an Antarctic treaty hadn't been done then, but was done, say, in 1976, just to pick a date out of the hat, there would have been an interdepartmental committee. Every element of the policy would have had to have been cleared by, you know, every department. There would have had to have been meetings at the NSC. People would have argued extreme positions to protect themselves, you know, for fear that some bad precedent might occur. And we had a military representative in our group. I mean, Daniels didn't exclude them. They were included, but they were pretty relaxed. And this was a good colonel. I think his name was Johnson. Have you seen the name?
Yes.
Johnson. So this was another factor that permitted us to do the job in a, you know, very serious, productive way without a lot of delays and detours and internal stalemates and leaks and so forth.
Yeah, it's pretty good.